Welcome to Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Our oncology CME group is very interested in current patterns of care and community practice, and we have been particularly interested in evaluating prostate cancer because of what appears to be significant differences in approaches between urologists and radiation oncologists. Several months ago, we published our first national patterns of care study in prostate cancer, in which U.S.-based urologists and radiation oncologists were randomly recruited to respond to a series of case scenarios of men with localized intermediate and high-risk disease and PSA-only progression. Most of the cases stipulated three theoretical patient ages so that we could obtain some insight into how age affects clinical decision-making. Dr. Mark Soloway consulted with our group to develop this survey, and I met with him to discuss the results. As with our prior studies of medical oncologists in breast and colorectal cancer, there was considerable heterogeneity in how physicians responded to clinical scenarios, and the next two interviews on this program provide the perspectives of radiation oncology investigators on these research-to-practice issues. The full report of our Patterns of Care survey can be accessed at www.patternsofcare.com. The first case I reviewed with Dr. Soloway was a patient with a PSA of 8.5 and 2 of 10 cores showing 20 to 30% positivity for Gleason 7, 4 plus 3 disease.
So this gentleman has certainly a significant prostate cancer, one that may indeed affect his life almost regardless of what age he is diagnosed. So if we look at the responses, we note that of interest, if a 48-year-old, at least 80% of the either urologist or radiation oncologist said that he ought to have a nerve-sparing radical prostatectomy. Well, I think that's quite interesting, and it shows you that at age 48, they are willing to take some risk with positive margins because of his age of 48 and the importance of erectile function in an individual of this age, and we have to assume he was potent before. Based on my own data, which we've published, where we compared men of all ages, all those who did or did not have a nerve sparing, and looked at the biochemical recurrence. Now, obviously, it's not a perfect analysis because there is some degree of selection, but since I try and do nerve sparing on just about everyone, there was no difference in biochemical recurrence. And the Mayo Clinic also, at least in abstract form at the AUA, and Dr. Catalone in his own series, subsequently indicated the same thing. So I would agree that unless there was some finding at the time of surgery that would say, guess what, the tumor is right there at the edge of the prostate, we should take that bundle. More often than not, in that situation, if you do take the bundle, there's a high chance there will be no cancer there. And leaving only one bundle gives a gentleman, even at 48, a very low likelihood of subsequent normal erections. Incidentally, frozen sections, which you say, well, why not do frozen sections? There are very few who would perform frozen sections. There is a recent study that is in press in European Urology that I've reviewed that suggests there's a marginal benefit in doing frozen sections. But it's not simple. You would only do frozen sections in an individual in which you felt something, and then you look at the area where you can feel the cancer. Remember, most cancers, many, are not palpable. And if your pathologist says, well, there's cancer there, that does not mean that if you now take that bundle on that side, that there's going to be cancer there. And even in this study that advocated doing frozen sections, a high percentage of those bundles did not contain cancer. So there's a real downside of doing so. The other reason for doing a nerve-sparing procedure is that if the cancer indeed is localized and you turn out you have a positive margin, or you monitor the PSA and intervene at the earliest sign of a biochemical recurrence, you do have a second opportunity, and that is with external beam radiation therapy. So that would be the thinking that I would agree with by both groups to do a nerve-sparing prostatectomy on this gentleman.
Although we should point out that 20% of the rad-oncs said that they would use some form of radiation therapy instead of surgery.
That's absolutely correct. Radiation oncologists feel in a 48-year-old, it would be equally reasonable to perform either external beam or brachytherapy plus external beam But again, it's only 20%. So again, the majority of radiation oncologists feel, presumably, either the side effect profile related to radiation therapy is somewhat diminished compared to surgery, or that there is a better chance of curing this 48-year-old individual, which I personally would agree with. Now, when the gentleman is 65 years old with all the same prognostic factors, that is, once again, a Gleason 7 in 2 of 10 cores with a PSA of 8, we note that 74% of the urologists want to, again, perform a nerve-sparing prostatectomy, but now the radiation therapists are heavily weighted toward either brachytherapy alone, brachytherapy with external beam, and probably the highest percent, 32%, want to proceed with external beam radiation therapy. And it's gone from 80% to 28% that would perform or suggest a radical prostatectomy. In my view, if he's 65 years old, the same fervor I would have, if you will, for a radical prostatectomy, and again, nerve sparing, I would suggest to a 65-year-old individual, I would certainly counsel them in either instance that there are no randomized studies that have compared these two alternatives, that is surgery and various forms of radiation therapy. My own bias, and I indicated it would be a bias, is that with radical prostatectomy, the treatment is what I consider in this day and age not a major operative procedure. My patients are actually out of the hospital in one day, almost uniformly. Most of the patients, we don't even leave a drain, 85% of them, in fact. We use a bikini-type low transverse incision. Robotic prostatectomy for others would be an alternative. So the impact on the individual is not very high. Urinary incontinence is very, very unlikely in my patients. The biggest side effect would be erectile dysfunction, some degree of impotence. Even with preserving the neurovascular bundles, that will be present in at least 30 to 40% of the men. And at 65, it would be at least that number.
And it's interesting, of the 70% of the radiation oncologists who would use radiation, almost half would also use androgen deprivation.
Yeah, I think that point is well stated, and that is that the BOLA study and subsequent RTOG studies really have, I'd say, fairly quickly made an impact in practice in that since this gentleman has Gleason score 7, although the PSA is less than 10, 25 to 30% of the respondents and the radiation oncologists would add androgen deprivation, and one could not disagree based on that study. The duration of androgen deprivation is still somewhat unclear, be it 1 year or 2 years or more. But if I were to perform a prostatectomy, of course, I would not, and consistent with the views here, add androgen deprivation at this point. Now, once the gentleman is 78 years old, clearly there is no very large group, with the exception of the strong feeling by the radiation oncologists, and that is 72% of them, feel that external beam radiation therapy and one-third would add androgen deprivation as the proper treatment or the best treatment choice for this individual. And actually, there's not too much of a different view from the urologist. At 78, of course, virtually nobody would perform major surgery, but either brachytherapy or external beam would be a good consideration. Of interest, though, in total, 29% of the urologists would add androgen deprivation, which is actually only slightly lower than suggested by the radiation oncologist. So it's interesting that probably because of the PSA of 8, they don't believe this is sufficiently high risk to add the androgen deprivation and the side effects that that brings with it.
How would you approach the 78-year-old?
I would certainly counsel the individual, and there the key is, of course, how long you think this individual is going to live. Because another very reasonable choice would be androgen deprivation alone. I don't see that as a bad alternative. I have a bias, and again, I think there is no data to indicate that it's correct, that androgen deprivation is somewhat less well tolerated in men in their late 70s. It's just the occasional, and probably as a urologist, you tend to see that patient because if they develop hematuria, they're going to see a urologist. If they develop rectal bleeding, they're going to see a gastrointestinal surgeon or a colorectal surgeon. And it's those few patients that tend to bias one. So I would counsel the patient if he wants a cure then I think it's entirely reasonable that he has radiation therapy. I personally don't perform brachytherapy, so I would either advise him to see a combination of a urologist and a radiation oncologist who are very good at that, and that's quite reasonable. Most of the patients I would talk to would be referred for external beam radiation therapy.
It's interesting how just the number of an age, you know, presented as a flat thing without seeing the patient will trigger different responses in physicians. And here we see when you go from age 65 to 78, a real drop-off in the use of surgery. Do you think there's sort of some magic number that, you know, gets you or other urologists to sort of push surgery aside?
Well, the magic number has varied around the 70 to 72 number. My own personal feeling is that, to me, body type is very important in this operation. If a thin individual, in all honesty, is a radical or a total prostatectomy, I think radical prostatectomy is really a misnomer. It's a total prostatectomy. And a thin individual, it's a very well-tolerated operation, and I tell the patient it is really not much different than a hernia repair, since they're only in the hospital one night. Of course, they have a catheter for a week. So in a thin 75-year-old individual, I think it's a fairly reasonable operation. The likelihood of transfusion approaches zero. Perioperative mortality with cardiac clearance is really not an issue anymore in many major medical centers. And the treatment is over in one day, as opposed to, if it's external beam, 7 weeks. So therefore, you want to compare it to brachytherapy in that term. Brachytherapy, depending on the size of the prostate, may require androgen deprivation to shrink the prostate, which is commonly used. Again, older men may have a large prostate, so that's a significant downside. To answer your question specifically, rarely would I perform the operation on anyone more than 74 or 75 unless he was some other reason, because again, there is a possibility of urinary incontinence, which is very low, but when that occurs, it's a major problem, and you really want to avoid that. Do older men have a little bit more of a problem? I think slightly so, although tolerated and not a major problem, but nonetheless, you're adding a surgical intervention to then the possibility of some urinary incontinence.
How about this next case, a patient with 4/10 cores positive?
Well, this is not an easy one indeed. Here we have a gentleman who has a PSA of 20, very adverse prognostic factor for curing him with local treatment. He's got a T2B lesion, the 40-gram prostate, and 4 cores positive for Gleason 4+3. Now, an MRI indicates, not suggests, indicates invasion to the right seminal vesicle. Bone scan is negative, and let's assume that a CAT scan or the MRI does not indicate any adenopathy, but with a PSA of 20, it is certainly more likely than not that he has systemic disease. So my thoughts with this gentleman, as I would have a lengthy conversation with him, is there an opportunity to cure him? And what is the best way to provide local control? If we look at the survey, we find at age 48, where this fellow's got 40 years to live if we're successful, that 42% of urologists in a 48-year-old would perform a prostatectomy. Only 10% of the radiation oncologists would suggest that as an option. 80% of them would suggest external beam radiation therapy, and 90% would add androgen deprivation. So they're going to follow what I think is the science and, if you will, the party line that this fellow is at high risk and you're going to need combination therapy. Urologists also, 67% of them, would also use androgen deprivation. That, I think, is interesting. So, my thoughts. At age 48, what is the best treatment for this individual? Unfortunately, we don't have one that's very likely to cure him. And I must indicate that in my experience, even men who fail, that having had the prostate removed provides better long-term quality of life. There are very few local problems. Since I can look back in my career many years, I remember during my residency years, so often men would come in, this was before the time when we were doing many prostatectomies, with ureteral obstruction, we were using radiation therapy, we were putting stents, percutaneous nephrostomies, etc. This was a regular occurrence. We really very infrequently see this now. Now, indeed, radiation therapy can also provide that benefit. Do I think it provides the exact same local control? I'm not convinced it does. Now, that does not mean that we should be performing radical prostatectomies in everybody with T3 disease. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, a 48-year-old gentleman, if I feel the prostate and it is mobile, and I think technically I can perform a prostatectomy on this individual without any different morbidity than the next person, I think it, one, eliminates the local problem. Number two, it provides a chance for a cure. I don't use the MRI to provide that much information. My DRE is going to be pretty helpful, because even men with seminal vesicle invasion can be cured. You're removing the seminal vesicle, even though, again, it is an adverse prognostic factor for systemic disease. So if technically I can perform the surgery, I have the opportunity for very safe external beam radiation therapy afterwards, if I think there is a possibility, depending on the PSA monitoring afterwards, that he has a local recurrence. So in a 48-year-old, if the prostate is mobile, I would say a prostatectomy is very reasonable. I would not give him, as the majority suggests, adjuvant systemic therapy. And I would probably monitor the PSA, but certainly at the earliest sign of a PSA recurrence, which is more likely than not in this individual, I would add androgen deprivation. Now, interestingly, among the urologists, when the individual reaches 65, only 24% would still follow through with wanting to perform a prostatectomy, and now most are going to give that patient radiation therapy, either seeds with external beam or external beam radiation therapy alone. And again, many would add androgen deprivation, and again, that would make sense.
What about, what would you do?
I think I would, again, a healthy 65 who was in a normal body type and not very heavy, I would follow the same reasoning as the 48-year-old.
And again, not using androgen deprivation.
I would not use androgen deprivation. But I certainly would consider using androgen deprivation early rather than later. First sign of biochemical recurrence with an initial PSA of 20, I would add androgen deprivation. At age 78 with this individual, certainly he's got a tumor that needs to be treated. I would absolutely go along with the radiation oncologists that want to use the combination of external beam radiation therapy with androgen deprivation. And I think the majority of urologists also would follow that, although it's in contrast. It's interesting that of the urologists in that 78-year-old individual, one-third of them would rely only on androgen deprivation, so not provide an opportunity for a cure, if you will, and they feel the disease is systemic and that radiation therapy would not provide a benefit. Again, I don't think there's a perfect answer. Probably my bias, given this patient, would depend a lot on how this gentleman looked. I think there is no right or wrong here. Both are very reasonable. Try and provide excellent local control with radiation therapy at the same time giving him the systemic benefit of androgen deprivation. Alternatively, one could argue this gentleman has systemic disease. At the age of 78, why add the morbidity of external beam radiation therapy? It's a tough call, and that would be one you sit down and discuss with the individual and see what he wants.
How about the next patient with the positive margins?
Well, this next gentleman provides one. Certainly there can be a lot of discussion about, and we have some randomized trials that are starting to provide somewhat mixed evidence. So this next gentleman is in good health. Let's start with the 48-year-old, because the responses are almost identical, so it really doesn't matter. He underwent a radical prostatectomy as well as a node dissection. The nodes are all negative. The pathology revealed a Gleason 7, 4 plus 3. His preoperative PSA was 8.5. His PSA was 0 at 6 weeks when he comes in, and that's the time we're going to discuss with him and highlight that the seminal vesicles were negative. That's a good thing. His lymph nodes, as I already mentioned, were negative. However, we will try and explain to him the implication of these one or two positive margins, and we can talk about both. One, if he had two positive margins, one was at the apex and one was posterior. And the question is what to do. Well, in the survey, we indicated that there were two positive margins, one at the apex and one posterior. And there's a difference in what urologists and what radiation oncologists would suggest. The urologists for both age groups a little more than a half, 60 to 70%, would observe this gentleman, monitoring their PSA, and then potentially intervene when the PSA rose. In contrast, almost two-thirds of the radiation oncologists at either age would suggest adjuvant external beam radiation therapy. And now I should say that 30 to 40% of urologists also would do so. The randomized trials, as I read it in this question, are not conclusive. There is no survival benefit in the Southwest Oncology study. There is a longer time to subsequent clinical recurrence. The way I would look at this patient is, one, he has a possibility that he has systemic disease because he has a Gleason 7. The location of the positive margin is important. A posterior margin means, as I understand it, and one would always want to look at the slides, but in most cases, simply means that the tumor has touched the edge where it abuts the perirectal fat. And most of those really do not indicate that that fellow will have a local recurrence. The apex is the most common site of a positive margin in most series, in our series as well, because that's where one is trying to be very careful to maximize urethral length to maintain continence. And the prostate often, in men, starts to extend around the urethra, of course, at that location, and one has to make a judgment where you divide the urethra, trying to, as much as possible, again, if you're doing a nerve-preserving procedure as well, you've got technical things that are very critical, trying not to leave any prostate. So this is a common site. Now, we have looked at our own data, and I think, if possible, all urologists should know their own data, which also means their own pathologists, how many sections they make. And we've recently published in the 2006 Journal of Urology, the first author was Michael Simon, approximately 900 men underwent a radical prostatectomy, and I think 30% had a positive margin, and we concentrated on that 30%. The question is, how many of those 30% who had a positive margin subsequently had a biochemical recurrence? In most series, it is 40 to 50%. In our series, only 20%. So that has greatly influenced what I do, because if I would give every one of those men radiation therapy, 80% would be overtreated by definition. Now, you can say some of them haven't relapsed yet, and they will, but our follow-up was approximately 3.5 to 4 years. So as I see it, to me, for my patients, unless I have several positive margins, and particularly with a Gleason 6, because I think they're more likely to have a local as opposed to systemic recurrence, my strong feeling is to monitor those patients. And as soon as the PSA begins rising or is above 0.4, which is the cutoff we use based on the Mayo Clinic analysis of what cut point to use for a recurrence, at that point, I would suggest if it's a long PSA doubling time, no seminal vesical invasion, certainly no lymph nodes, and most likely Gleason 6, possibly a Gleason 7, those patients would get radiation therapy. Interestingly, out of 1,500 patients that I've performed a radical prostatectomy, only 44 have received radiation therapy. And our overall survival is equivalent to many of the top centers in the country. So I don't think that approach disadvantages the patients. I'm aware of the JAMA article, which suggests a benefit from radiation therapy after prostatectomy. I remain unconvinced. There are side effects. The side effects are not great, but they can be devastating in a very small group of patients. That is, they were continent and then became incontinent, bladder problems. I don't dismiss the problem of radiation therapy causing second cancers. We know that rectal cancer is increased in men who have had radiation therapy to the pelvis. And although statistically it's not profound, I think external beam radiation therapy increases the chance of bladder cancer. And we've seen a number of such cases. So that, again, one has to consider that among the factors. So in essence, I would side here with the urologist, and I would follow these patients, as 60% would do. The radiation oncologists, I'm not surprised. Their teaching is, if there's tumor that might be present earlier rather than later, smaller volume is better than not. They feel confident they can deliver the radiation therapy safely. Most would not add androgen deprivation, and I think they know the literature. There's really no data to suggest that that's important.
How about this next case of the patient with a positive seminal vesicle?
I have some difference of opinion with the respondents, be it urologist or medical oncologist. He underwent a radical prostatectomy, and he was found to have Gleason 4 plus 3 or 7. His preoperative PSA was 8.5. And the key thing is, although his lymph nodes were negative, the right seminal vesicle had invasion of tumor. Now, the first question is, what is his chance of relapse? And the answer is, it's 50%, probably greater. And as one we follow these individuals longer and longer, it goes up to about 80%. So a high likelihood he eventually will have biochemical recurrence, but it may take several years for that to occur, and certainly for his demise may take 8-10 years, and that would probably be the average. So the question is, what are your choices as you sit down with him? Follow him, androgen deprivation, either adjuvant and continue it for a period of time, maybe going to intermittent androgen deprivation or continuous androgen deprivation, or possibly radiation therapy. When we sit down with this individual to discuss this, we have obtained a PSA, and it's less than 0.4, or the equivalent of zero. So I would tell him his risk of relapse, but I'm saying the good news is the margins are indicated to be negative and that he may be cured. I probably wouldn't tell him that that likelihood is somewhere between 15 and 30%. My own bias is if this gentleman is going to recur, it will not be local recurrence. And I'm very convinced from our own series that that's the case. So I would not add the morbidity, even small, of radiation therapy. The individuals who have had this pathology, who have had radiation therapy, mostly for a very low PSA recurrence, like 0.5, 0.6, usually always less than 1.0, uniformly have relapsed. So I'm unconvinced that external beam radiation therapy as an adjuvant or even for biochemical recurrence will have this patient as a cure from his prostate cancer. So I would strongly differ then from the 50 to 60% from both urologists and radiation oncologists, regardless of the patient's age, that they should get either monotherapy with radiation therapy or add, which 20 to 30% want to do, androgen deprivation. I would give this gentleman, if he recurs, at some point initiate androgen deprivation. What that magic PSA is would be a discussion with the patient. So I would not use radiation therapy. I differ from the majority here, although slightly less than the majority would agree with me, but I'm quite surprised with this response.
You know, it's interesting looking throughout this whole survey, and we've seen this, and we've done surveys in breast cancer and colon cancer with medical oncologists and seeing the same thing, the tremendous diversity in how people, sometimes we present cases and we have 15 different approaches. It really brings in the fact that even within the same specialty, how much diversity we see.
Absent of randomized trials, I think you're going to have that. And fortunately, we're starting to have some. We've already talked about how the BOLA study has disseminated the information, impacted what individuals do, the RTOG. But for this patient, unfortunately, we don't have any solid information that we're going to provide an impact with these treatments. And why so many people want radiation therapy, I think that JAMA article has influenced many of these, because the headline there was, allow the patient to have external beam radiation therapy, there's a 50% chance that this patient will be, I won't use the word cured, but you will profoundly affect his PSA and they will do much better with that. Personally, I don't believe that information.
Why
not? I
don't
think it, again, from my own personal experience, local recurrence is extremely unlikely. That is defined in either two ways, palpable, CT, using those together as one way, but alternatively, in my limited experience, patients who've had radiation therapy and had seminal vesicle invasion, they've all failed. That means despite adding radiation therapy at a very low PSA recurrence, they have failed.
How do you explain the data then?
I think the follow-up is too short, and the follow-up is short in most of those studies, and particularly in the JAMA one. So I think if one continues to follow those patients, yes, some of them, their PSA will go down a little bit. So there might be some local neoplasm, but they also have systemic disease. And you've added the morbidity, forget the expense, you've added the morbidity of radiation therapy. But it does occur on occasion.
What about the next case, the patient with a PSA only relapse and a 12-month doubling time?
The next gentleman has already had two local treatments, if you will. He had a radical prostatectomy for Gleason 3 plus 4 or 7. Initial PSA pre-prostatectomy or at diagnosis was 8.5. Things look good initially with absence of tumor and lymph nodes. The seminal vesicles and margins were negative, and his nadir was 0, so the surgery went well. He did not have any significant side effects from surgery, but unfortunately, his PSA begins to rise. He then received external beam radiation therapy. And again, my own bias, as I've already indicated, I would not have given this gentleman for sure radiation therapy because he had negative margins, he had negative seminal vesicles, and unfortunately, the Gleason grade 4 spread before his prostatectomy. And unless one felt something on his DRE, which would be unlikely, I would not have given him radiation. And what happened is what happens with virtually all of my patients who did get radiation therapy as they subsequently relapsed. And at this point, I believe this gentleman should have androgen deprivation. And the question is there a number, is there a PSA number which one begins this? I think there has been a trend to earlier androgen deprivation. You say, well, why, what impacted this? I think the so-called messing study with positive lymph nodes, even though it was a small study, and you've talked about this so frequently in your tapes with a number of individuals that you've interviewed, but nonetheless, you can't totally discount the study. And I think there is a benefit to earlier rather than later androgen deprivation. I think that's one of the impacts of the Tyrol study and why their patients have, within 2 to 3 years, in their big, huge PSA screening throughout that area of Austria, that there was an impact in survival when compared to other parts of Austria, is that not only they provided diagnosis but initiated treatment. And since that benefit was seen within just a short number of years, I think the impact of hormone therapy was indeed part of it, and I think George Bartsch has indicated as such. So the question is, if we initiate androgen deprivation, the two big issues is, should you continue it, or should you provide the patient with the opportunity for intermittent therapy? And I happen to think intermittent therapy is quite a reasonable approach. I indicate to the patients, we are yet to have randomized trials indicating their equivalent, that the standard has always been, and probably still is, the quote, the standard, continuous androgen deprivation. But my own bias is depending on the patient's age, his tolerance of the androgen deprivation, and how long he's been on it, that it is reasonable to stop it at some point and monitor the PSA. The second issue, I should say parenthetically, that somewhere between 20 and 30% of the respondents, be it age a patient 48 or 65, would agree that intermittent therapy is reasonable. So the majority still would stick with continued androgen deprivation, but a sizable one-fifth to one-third think intermittent therapy is reasonable. Now the second issue is, should this just be an LHRH agonist alone, or should we add an anti-androgen, and the most common one used in the United States is bicalutamide? Interesting, only 5 to 10% would block with the just 1 month. And just for a rising PSA, a third or 20 to 30% will use continuous combined androgen deprivation with an LHRH analog along with, for example, bicalutamide in this instance. I would actually be in the minority category here. I would always give it for approximately 1 month. If a patient had metastatic disease, overt metastatic disease, then I believe there is some benefit of androgen deprivation when used in combination adding the LHRH analog with Casodex or bicalutamide. But in this instance where this gentleman is going to be on androgen deprivation for many years, I'm unconvinced that that benefit is substantial enough to add the bicalutamide. So I would probably go with initial combined therapy, but after a month, I would just use the LHRH analog.
What's the downside of using MAB?
The downside is only cost. That's it.
Would you present it to the patient as an option if they wanted to pay for it and say there might be a slight benefit?
I would indicate to the patient that I do believe there is a slight benefit. I am convinced from the studies that I participated in, and I certainly have heard all of the data extensively, and I do think, and I think Laurie Klotz is the one who's best put that information together, and I think he's a very honest investigator, and I would follow the data. I'd say there is some benefit. It's small. And if you want to pay the additional expense of doing so, that it is reasonable to do so.
Now, you said that you often use or reconsider intermittent therapy in this situation. Every time you restarted it, would you also use a flare blockage with the antiandrogen?
Sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't.
You know, again, it's interesting to consider other aspects of cancer medicine. And you know, we're seeing the biologics now in breast cancer, lung cancer, colon cancer, you know, huge price tabs that make antiandrogens look like nothing. And, you know, in many cases, the benefits are no greater than what you see for MAB. So it's interesting how maybe once the biologics start getting into prostate cancer, it'll look a little bit different.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely correct. And I think a lot has to do with the reimbursement issue.
Right.
Certainly urologists will perform procedures in the office that reimburse them a substantial amount with negligible benefit in some cases to the patient, and don't think twice about a couple thousand dollars to do a procedure. Yet here you have some benefit and we're quote unquote hung up on a $8 to $10 a day pill. So your point's very well taken, and I would agree that we should provide absolutely with patients with advanced disease, that is metastatic disease, and possibly patients with positive lymph nodes and maybe rising PSA, the benefit, given the data, of adding an antiandrogen.
Let's talk about the next case with a patient with a rising PSA after primary external beam therapy.
This next gentleman is in good health. He underwent external beam radiation therapy for a Gleason 3 plus 4, 7, PSA 8.5 prostate cancer. His PSA nadir dropped down to 0.6 at 12 months and then began to rise a little bit. It was actually by 30 months, 0.9, and rose just a little bit more. So by 3 years, it was 1.2. So it's rising slowly. Let's now indicate that he has a prostate biopsy, which I think is absolutely critical. And there is a focus of Gleason 6 or 7 prostate cancer. If we talk about a 48-year-old individual, I think we should at least discuss salvage prostatectomy. And actually, I would probably discuss it as well with a 65-year-old individual. There are several things we should indicate to the patient. The likelihood that a second treatment will cure him is possible, but not very high. Your best treatment is always the first one. Now, if we first look at the answers given by the respondents, 50% of both the urologist and radiation oncologist said they would just follow this individual because clearly he is not likely to be symptomatic for probably many years. The second most common answer is cryotherapy. 1 in 5 would use cryotherapy. Cryotherapy, as I see it, is very user-dependent. The primary side effect, which this gentleman possibly has already, is erectile dysfunction. Those who use it successfully indicate that it's very important to freeze the entire prostate and adjacent tissue. Obviously, you have to be careful about the rectum. But the techniques have improved, and there is some benefit in this category. I don't think it's widely used, but possibly more so than at least in our community where I don't think there's a lot of utilization of it. Let me just concentrate on the 1 in 6 or 15% that would consider a prostatectomy. And actually, I would consider it under the following provisos. One, I would want to feel the prostate. If the prostate is very flat, I would be more reluctant to consider a prostatectomy. But more and more radiation therapy, be it external beam or interstitial therapy, one could consider a salvage prostatectomy with either. But I like to feel the prostate as close to quote-unquote normal as possible. I would hope the patient not be very overweight, because I think that's important in the technique of a prostatectomy. Now, in my experience, and it's not an extensive one, I'm very selective, but in the patients that have had a salvage prostatectomy in that category, our continence rate is excellent. Only one patient out of about 15 has had an artificial sphincter. The others are quite continent. And probably 70% of them have had no biochemical recurrence. Again, very highly selected population. In this patient, since he's got a 3 plus 4, a fairly long doubling time, again, the key is we have a biopsy. He's had a bone scan. That was negative. I think a salvage prostatectomy would be a very reasonable consideration. And I would consider it even for the individual at 65 if he was in excellent health. Now, that differs from most of the other respondents who suggested either observation, presumably with delayed androgen deprivation, or the second most common choice, 20% with cryotherapy.
Let's talk a little bit about the issue, what we found in the survey in terms of referral to medical oncology and perceptions about chemotherapy for prostate cancer.
I think we've gotten to a new era. Patients with a rising PSA prior to the Taxotere era were treated with different forms of second-line androgen deprivation, possibly mitoxantrone, which I find had little benefit. I think we now have an agent that is pretty well tolerated, almost independent of age, highly likely to provide a biochemical relapse, if you will, that is the PSA usually will drop, and in symptomatic patients, often a profound benefit. I think the tolerance is very important when you add it together with the clinical benefit. Now, let's see what our respondents feel about chemotherapy. When we asked them, is chemotherapy more effective in 2005 than 10 years ago? Clearly, 80% of urologists or radiation oncologists feel that the answer to that question is a strong yes, agree or strongly agree. And is it better tolerated? Same numbers. Yes, indeed, it's better tolerated than before and safer, if you will. Now, the question comes up, when do you refer a patient with a rising PSA to a medical oncologist? And do you wait for symptoms? My own bias is that as soon as someone has a rising PSA and is concerned about it, is on androgen deprivation, I think then is the time that they should hook up with a medical oncologist who you trust, who you work with, tell the patient, as a urologist, I want to continue to monitor you, to evaluate any local problems you have, but that I think it's time to see a medical oncologist as the opportunities for benefit in treating your disease are much better than they were years ago.
It would have been interesting to do this survey 3 or 4 years ago. I think we might have seen pretty different results.
Oh, I think there's no question about it. Well, I don't know what's actually going on in the community. Certainly, I know what our group is doing, and we have 2 or 3 medical oncologists that we regularly refer these patients to early and like taking care of these individuals. The issue over the next few years is to take a drug like Taxotere, which is currently in trials for high-risk, albeit clinically localized, prostate cancer, and see if it can impact on the efficacy of our current treatments. It was raised to me actually by a resident today when I saw a high-risk patient with Gleason 8. And he said, Dr. Soloway, we're aware of the success with Taxotere for advanced disease, metastatic disease, hormone refractory. What about using that as neoadjuvant, as adjuvant in patients with positive lymph nodes, positive sentinel vesicles? And should that patient provide the information to get on such a trial? And it is. We get used to our thinking of, well, let's reserve it for more advanced disease. One of the difficulties with Taxotere is that, in my view, you have relatively little side effects until you get to about 6 or 8 months on treatment, and then you start getting some significant side effects. And when you have a patient that you know is likely to live 7 to 8 years, to me, you have to have pretty convincing evidence that you're going to impact this 6 or 8 years in a positive way before adding those side effects. For instance, neuropathy. that they may get from taxotere?
If you're talking about a patient who has PSA-only disease, it's a little bit similar to adjuvant therapy in that there's no gross disease. And if you think about the breast cancer model, they get short-term chemotherapy, maybe 4 or 6 months, and then long-term hormone therapy. And there are trials now looking at that in prostate cancer. And, you know, so maybe to go through 4 or 6 months of chemotherapy might be worth it in the long run.
Oh, I think it might be. The question is, do we want to see the trials first? Or are we willing to take a leap of faith with our current patients, albeit few, with Gleason 8, 9, and 10, and say, look, it works in metastatic disease. Let's give the benefit to the patient while we're waiting trials. It's always the question, while we're waiting for the trials to provide that information, should we offer it to the patients? And I think we don't currently, but I certainly would not argue with someone who wanted to do so. And maybe an opportunity to get the medical oncologist involved and say, look, we'll hear from the individual who's going to be giving the treatments, has a lot of experience in doing so, and it may provide a benefit and doesn't have a great deal of side effects.